As executive director of the Center for Victims of Torture, Kurt Gehring oversees an international staff with offices in Atlanta, St. Paul, and Washington, D.C., as well as healing projects in Africa and the Middle East. The Center for Victims of Torture provides comprehensive care for victims of government-sponsored torture. They conduct research and training. I am happy to introduce you to today's guest, Kurt Gehring. Kurt, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brewer. It's great to be with you.
Now, Kurt, you heard me describe all the things that you do. So clearly you're working in an 86-hour day. Tell us about the decision to work with torture victims of government-sponsored torture. What do you mean by government-sponsored torture?
Well, the Convention Against Torture, which arises out of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was agreed to by the United Nations 70 years ago, is a convention, a treaty that grew out of that Universal Declaration, a treaty that governments developed, they signed, they ratified, and they're now responsible to implement. So while the treaty was only signed by governments, the criminal law and the international humanitarian law that also arose out of that direction applies not only to government sanctioned abuse, but also by torture that's committed by non-governmental entities. So CVT actually works with both survivors of both, but our main focus is on survivors who have experienced torture at the hands of government officials.
And how do you identify these victims of torture?
Well, unfortunately, they're not hard to identify, and they come to us in various ways. If we happen to be in a new location, or we hear about situations where a torture is in a significant part of a repressive or oppressive operation somewhere, then we might have a team in the field that helps survivors and often refugees who have fled the country. It helps them understand the what happens, what the symptoms of torture are, how it affects someone psychologically as well as physically. So some of those individuals are identified or self-identified through those kinds of sessions. Many of them show up at our clinics in Africa or the Middle East. Some are referred to us by former, we call them clients, survivors who've been through our rehabilitative programs and who understand how their lives, how they've been better able to cope and live with their traumatic experience after having worked with CVT or been through the Center for Victims of Torture Rehabilitative Program. And so they see others who've experienced similar situations and refer them to us. So, they come to us in a range of ways, and every day there are new arrivals at our doorsteps.
What are some of the symptoms that you commonly see that are experienced by individuals who have experienced torture?
Survivors come to us with both physical and psychological symptoms. They might come with the scars of torture, or the evidence of sheer physical brutality, the beatings, the broken bones, the teeth having been, knocked out, electric shocks, cigarette burns, beatings on the soles of feet. They may have, they may be physically wounded, and there's a whole range of methods, as you and your listeners, can imagine. But there are also many psychological forms of torture, which don't leave the scars and don't leave the physical evidence in the same way. They're hidden scars, and they're no less severe. And often survivors tell us they're even worse to live with, to try to cope with, than the physical brutality. Things like being subjected to mock executions, for example, being forced to watch family members being tortured. Sometimes, and this unfortunately has happened in far too many locations, where child soldiers are, you know, children are abducted from their homes or villages and are forced to participate in militias and often, unfortunately, often kill members of their own family or kill their neighbors or their relatives. And, you know, those, you know, there might not be physical scars, symptoms of that, but it's quickly evident that they bear incredible psychological scars and damage from what they've been forced to do.
Well, just, you know, a quick flash of imagining a child who is forced into the life of being a soldier and then forced to kill a family member. I mean, the trauma is almost unimaginable.
That's absolutely right, Dr. Brewer, because you know, this is a feature of recruitment in some of the wars that we've seen in recent decades. For example, one of the most prominent and most widely known, although still not nearly known enough, is the tactic used and the strategies used by a group called the Lord's Resistance Army in the north of Uganda in the 1980s and 1990s, where a central part of their strategy was to recruit children from villages in the north of Uganda and then force them to become sometimes child soldiers, sometimes to become porters to carry supplies. But part of the training process, and often to become, you know, so-called wives of militia commanders, where, you know, they were sexually abused. They often bore children as a result of the rapes, and that was a part of their program that was designed to break children from their parents if they weren't forced to kill their parents, you know, by virtue of the being abducted and being subjected to what they were forced to do. It created this division, of course, this incredible gap between the family members and the abducted children.
And what
so
was
it's
the,
not only
what were the age range of these children?
You know, it ranged from 6, 7, 8 year olds. All the way up to, you know, 17, 18. So it was quite common during that period in villages of the north of Uganda that militia members of the Lord's Resistance Army, as it was called, abducted children from their villages, from their homes during the night and took them off to become part of the militia. You know, it was so widespread that there was a phenomenon during that period known as child commuters, because there was such a fear in that part of Uganda during that period that children would be abducted, that they moved at night, the children, to centers, United Nations centers, or places of refuge in larger villages and some small cities, where they left for the night, and that's why they were called night commuters. They traveled by foot at dusk. They slept in these places of refuge for the night, and then went back, you know, to their homes the following morning. And the reason for that is because they were so fearful that they would be abducted by militia members if they stayed at home.
Kurt Gehring, who is the executive director of Center for Victims of Torture. We're going to take a break. Kurt, we'll be back in just a moment. Folks, my name is Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Mind Talk. ¶¶ as I listen to the descriptions of some of the things, some of the experiences that your clients have had, it almost brings tears to my eyes. And I wonder how you and your staff deal with this on a daily basis.
Yeah, it's a part of our workplace, and especially, but not only for clinicians, our psychotherapists, psychologists, the doctors, the medical personnel that work with the nurses, the social workers. They're most directly confronted with this on a daily basis. But it's not only the clinicians; it's also those who, in our communications or our a development staff who put out the materials, who write up the testimonies where for distribution, those who work with the media in explaining what happens. So it's really we have to pay a lot of attention to issues of secondary trauma. And that means that we're cognizant that is an impact of working with survivors of torture, and that we need to take appropriate measures in order to try to minimize the possibility of staff becoming too overwhelmed and burning out. So we try to pay a lot of attention to self-care, for example. And have built that into our workplace culture and environment. Staff are very committed and deeply dedicated to this work. And at the same time, to be effective in their work, they also need to take care of themselves. And so this is a constant struggle in many ways because the needs are overwhelming. We always have waiting lists at each of our locations, and staff naturally want to be as helpful as they can be and help as many as we can assist. And yet, in order to do that in the most effective way, the staff themselves need to be healthy in all senses of the word. And so it's really important that people take care of themselves. We are very fortunate to have at the Center for Victims of Torture staff who've done this work, including the clinical staff, for 20 years, for 25 years. We have one senior clinician who has been with us almost since the beginning of the Center for Victims of Torture, over 30 years now. CVT was founded in 1985, and this particular clinician has been with us for over 30 of those years.
Sounds like that clinician needs to have a month-long vacation every year. Have I
Yeah.
just added to
Yeah.
your budget?
No, it's well deserved. It's needed, and it's well deserved. But it really is. We are so fortunate organizationally to have individuals on staff who are the most experienced, I would say, in the world in dealing with torture survivors. I mean, it's not a large field. It's actually pretty narrow and very specialized. And of course, psychotherapy and psychology is an important background, physiotherapy, to social work training. But to apply those skills and that discipline specifically to survivors of torture and war-related trauma is quite, specialized in many respects. And we are fortunate to have, quite a number of staff who've been with us for a long time, and the value of that experience and learning over the years, and in some cases decades, of how we can provide the most effective care to help survivors get back on their feet again, those who need specialized support. And not all of them do, but many of them do, psychologically or physically, and often both. What we learn over having worked with now tens of thousands of individual survivors of torture, it really informs our methodology and how we structure our work going forward. And that's really important because we want to be as effective and impactful as we can be. The numbers of survivors are very, very large. In the United States, we estimate there are as many as 1,300,000 torture survivors in the U.S. And not all of them are in need of specialized care, but many of them are. And so part of our mission is to rebuild, to heal the wounds of torture on as many of those individuals as we possibly can.
Kurt, you've talked about dealing with so many people who were victims of torture. You yourself have been all over the world, Afghanistan, Bosnia, Israel, Taiwan. Would you say that there is any particular place that you have been or any particular person with whom you have interacted that has had a particular impact on you?
Yes, Dr. Brew, there are situations that one comes across in the course of the work that I have done and that this organization does that leave, particular lasting impacts, or individuals whose interactions with you leave an indelible impression, which stay with you. And, there are several of those from Afghanistan or from Iraq or from Gaza, where I spent some time. But one of the common strains of those impressions is the remarkable resiliency of individuals, of human beings who suffered, these incredible traumatic experiences, the absolute worst that any human being can experience. And it's not a trauma resulting from a natural disaster. It's what one human being does to another human being. And yet, people are able, with a little bit of support and professional help, to find within them the courage and the strength to move beyond that traumatic event, to move beyond their torture, and create new lives, to rebuild their lives, and they go on to do amazing things. Even if it's going back to school, reconnecting with one's family, some of them become really important figures in the specialized fields that they work on. I think of, for example, individuals like Juan Mendez, who was tortured in Argentina during the military junta in the 70s and early 80s, who had a horrible experience, and he's written about this and described this, but has gone on to become a very prominent human rights activist and academic, but also became the United Nations Special Rapporteur on torture. So here is someone who is a survivor, experienced that kind of horrendous treatment at the hands of the Argentinian junta, who went on to become an amazing advocate against torture at the highest circles of the United Nations.
For folks who are thinking that this is something that this is a field that they might want to be a part of, what would you say are some core skills or mindsets that they need to have?
Well, I first would encourage those who might be interested in this line of work to pursue that interest. And the torture rehabilitation movement, as we call it, of which my center is a leader, but is also a part, because there are other organizations that are also working in this field. Most of them, quite small, and mostly staffed by clinical staff. So we need psychotherapists. We need people who have social work backgrounds, people who are physiotherapists. But we also need people who are fundraisers, people who understand how to do grant accounting, the financial staff. We need people who are skilled in information technology, people who are skilled at running particular programs in various countries. So, we look for people who can best fit the job that's being recruited for. But really, we need people who understand and who have a deep commitment to human rights, humanitarian work, who are committed to their fellow human beings, who bring their professional and want to apply their professional expertise and experience to these kinds of situations. You know, increasingly, we are looking for a staff that represents both the country that we live in, but also the places where we operate. So in Jordan, for example, most of our staff are Jordanian or Palestinian staff.
I see.
In Kenya, for example, where we will have soon about 150 staff, they are almost all Kenyan or Somali Kenyan. So we're very much moving forward with an emphasis to building a sustainable organization with local health professionals and other professionals from, you know, who are indigenous, so that although we are an international NGO, you know, the work is best understood and best carried out with local professionals. And that's increasingly what we are looking for.
Kurt, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we will get more information about how people can be helpful in the work that you do. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We will be back in just a moment. Kurt, one of the things that struck me as you were describing the kinds of skills that you were looking for, you know, a lot of times when people hear about trauma work, the assumption is that the only people who are needed are trauma clinicians. So it was really interesting for me to hear you expand that out to IT people, fundraising people. I think that really helps listeners to understand that you can be other than a clinician and still be engaged in this incredibly important work.
Absolutely, Dr. Brewer. It's, you know, vitally important to run, if one is going to run a larger organization, to have the, you know, the kinds of expertise, the institutional building expertise that allows us to run the kinds of programs that we run. So I didn't mention, for example, researchers, you know, scientists, you know, people who are skilled at evaluating work. You know, we, for example, did a recently completed a randomized controls trial, you know, which is a quite sophisticated scientific operation. And in order to do that, you know, we needed trained researchers and people who knew what to look for, people who knew how to evaluate, how to do intake assessments, how to do follow-up work, how to decipher the analytics that were gained, how to draw conclusions from the information, from the data that was gathered. You know, advocacy is another area with an advocacy office in Washington, D.C., and this is an area that is becoming increasingly important for us. We treat and work with survivors of torture, but we also work on policies that affect torture survivors or torture survivor funding. So we need people in Washington, D.C. who understand, you know, the legislative process, the appropriations and authorizations process, who can develop the skills and the networks or bring those networks with Congress or with the State Department, because those are important actors with us in implementing our mission. So it really it's the entire spectrum of you know, jobs that are required to run an organization like ours. But of course, central to that and the core activity of ours is the working with survivors and the clinical approach. And therefore the psychotherapists, the physiotherapists, the social workers, et cetera.
You know, again, I really appreciate your sort of broadening, providing a broad perspective of what it takes to do the work that you do. You know, at the risk of repeating myself, I know that there are so many people who are likely listening, who say, I want to help, but I'm not a clinician, I'm not a therapist, so what do I do? So I really appreciate that. Very quickly, we've been talking about victims of torture, but now we're also talking about outlets that you have, as you described, in Washington, D.C., St. Paul, Atlanta. You know, for those people who believe that torture and the results of torture only happen over there and not over here, wherever over here may be, what do you want them to recognize as we close out our conversation today?
Well, one thing I think it's important to understand is that torture, unfortunately, continues to be a widespread and systematic practice, unfortunately, in too many countries around the world, and often not an isolated event. That too often it is part and parcel of government policy to stifle dissent, to try to control, to intimidate the opposition, to try to, you know, gather information, and so it's a widespread problem. But it's also true that it can be contained and it can be stopped. And those who have experienced it, those are traumatic experiences. But it is possible, and we see this again and again, that individuals are able to, again, with only sometimes a tiny amount of specialized attention, are able to move beyond their torture and go on to create, you know, new lives and productive lives. And it is so rewarding to, you know, to see how resilient and how courageous people are, and what they're able to do. So, you know, we need the support of as many contributors, for example, as we can find, and who would support this mission. We also need people to take action when there are issues in Congress or policies that are promulgated by this administration that have a negative impact on torture survivors, many of whom, most of our clients, for example, are asylum seekers. And the restrictions now being imposed on asylum seekers are very detrimental to the recovery process of torture survivors here in the United States.
Kurt Gehring, Executive Director of Center for Victims of Torture. Very, very quickly, can you give us your web address?
Yeah, our web address is CVT, Center for Victims of Torture, .org, CVT, .org. And there's information there about the places we work, what we do, about our staff, how people can become involved, what actions they can take, and how they might contribute.
Wonderful. Thank you again so much, Kurt Gehring, Executive Director, Center for Victims of Torture. Thank you, Kurt.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brewer.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may do, that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. I absolutely encourage you to take a look at the website for Center for Victims of Torture if you would like to help in any way. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. And at the website, you can sign up for free gifts. You can learn more about the other platforms where you can access Mind Talk. If you'd like to send an email to me, that's PAMELA at myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.